Welcome to the Boost VC podcast, where we talk to incredible guests building our sci-fi future. We're going to dig into the latest topics around venture capital, startups, and sci-fi technologies. I'm your host, Adam Draper, founder and managing director of Boost VC, and I'm a fourth generation venture capitalist. Are you ready to rock? Today's episode of the Boost VC podcast was recorded in front of a live studio audience. I've always wanted to say that, so that happened. On today's episode of the Boost VC podcast, in front of a live studio audience, I got to interview Joey Krug, who's the co-chief investment officer at Pantera Capital, where they invest in crypto. So it's blockchain, digital currency, crypto assets. So they invest in the entire spectrum. He is also the creator of Augur, which is a prediction markets-based blockchain. And live, it's a live blockchain. On today's episode, in front of a live studio audience, we talked about prediction markets, obviously. We talked about regulatory uncertainty, and we talked about really getting from idea to raising capital and how ICOs worked before the hype cycle of 2017. I love Joey. I think he's amazing. I think he's got a great pulse on the crypto world. And I really hope that you listen, subscribe, and learn. So thank you. Welcome to the Boost VC podcast. I do it for every podcast, so I thought I'd do it for this also. I'm really excited to have Joey here with us at Boost VC. This is actually our first live podcast, just in case you were wanting to feel special. And okay, so I was just telling Joey this, but the first time I met Joey was at this venture capital roundtable thing. It was over in Menlo Park somewhere. But we each were talking about different crypto in different rooms. And then he had this whole, I hadn't heard the word stable coin yet. Okay, so I hadn't heard the word stable coin or stable token. And his whole entire conversation was about how stable tokens were going to be the most important thing. And I argued with him for like 10 minutes. Everyone else was supportive and I just didn't think it was going to be a thing. And now over the last like 3 years of being proven wrong on that topic, have come around on it. I don't think you were working at Pantera at that point.
I think I was. I don't know. It might have been right around when I just joined.
I think it might have been right around when you were just joined. I remember someone from PwC being there too. Okay. Well, Joey Krug is here. He's the creator of Augur and he's at Pantera Capital as an investor. And welcome.
Thanks.
Okay. Well, why don't we start by having you walk through what led you to Augur, which led you to Pantera?
Sure. Yeah. So initially, I guess I'll start with kind of Bitcoin because that's where it usually starts for most people. Is I came across Bitcoin in 2011 in a forum called Overclock.net.
What is over? What was it?
Yeah, so Overclock.net's this random forum about like overclocking your computer, so making your CPU or your graphics card kind of run at a higher speed than it comes out of the box with.
That's awesome. That's how you learned about Bitcoin?
Yeah. So there was this thread that was basically like, hey, you can earn free money with your graphics card if you download this software and mine Bitcoin. And I was like, that seems like a scam. And so I just ignored it. And 6 weeks later, I checked this site every morning. It was like one of the things I first did before going to school is I checked this site. And one morning I was like, okay, you know what? This post has been the number one post on the forum for 6 weeks straight. I should check it out. Because these guys aren't stupid. They're like overclocking their computers. Like you can't be an idiot to do that. So I was like, I'll check it out. Maybe they're not wrong.
And they owned you every morning.
Yeah, they had my eyeballs.
And so then, okay, so you had to buy Bitcoin in order to clock your computer? Was that?
No, it was completely unrelated. Oh. These guys were just like, hey, like we have these graphics cards that run really fast because we overclock them as a hobby. And somebody had this idea like, hey, we should mine Bitcoin with them. And so he proposed it to the forum. And that's kind of my first exposure to Bitcoin.
And that's how Bitmain was born. I'm kidding. Okay, so that's how you got into Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And then I think I've listened to a couple of your podcasts that you've been interviewed on, and you said that you really wanted it to be you wanted Bitcoin to be this disruptive like money, basically, right?
Yep.
And it didn't feel like it was going to happen. Was that how Augur was founded?
Yeah, essentially. So the idea was, like, I thought Bitcoin was going to be like so disruptive to the financial system, and that didn't really happen. Instead, it just kind of became this investment asset, which is cool, but it wasn't like this like 0 to 1 or 0 to 100 improvement that I thought was possible with the tech.
And so what was the premise behind Augur originally?
Yeah, so the premise behind Augur...
And is it still that premise?
Yeah, it's actually one of the few things that's kind of stayed the same. Is so in 2014, I'd been at universities going to school studying computer science. I just finished my first year. And that was kind of right after the 2013 run-up and then collapse in Bitcoin price. And I really just thought, you know, I've got to do something in this space because I think it's super fascinating. And I don't know if the opportunity will still be here 4 years from now. Turns out that was wrong. Opportunity is still definitely here. it's still like, you know, 1989 or 1990 on the internet analog. But I think
we're 20 years later, Amazon has figured it out.
Yeah. But basically the idea was, you know, let's see what we can actually do to disrupt the financial system with this tech. And for Augur, the concept was, okay, look at finance. What exists? There's real world assets. We could try to tokenize real world assets. I was like, that's a pain. You got to deal with the real world. You have to like talk to people and stuff. I don't want to do that. So the other idea was derivatives. They're synthetic. They don't involve the external world too much. And that's one of the best benefits of the tech, I think, is when you purely kind of involve the virtual world, because blockchains have all these security properties. But if you have to trust a third party in the outside world, it dilutes a lot of those properties. And so that's how I kind of hit upon, okay, derivatives is the way to do this. And, you know, synthetic assets, basically betting. And that's kind of how Augur got started.
Had you ever built a sort of company before founding Augur?
No, I just done like some mobile apps and stuff.
So these are all projects, right? Like Augur is a project. You're not the CEO of Augur.
Right.
So you don't dictate what goes on. It's an open source.
Nope.
Okay. Like from your perspective, like what's the difference between starting a project like Augur and just starting a company that sells cookies?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think, you know, the big difference is for something like Augur, even though I have a pretty influential voice in it, I don't really have the final say. It's more like Ethereum or Bitcoin in that sense, where like I can state my opinion and say like, hey, as one of the people who helped create this thing in the very beginning, you know, I think we should do X, Y, and Z going forward. But the difference is like if you start a company selling cookies and I say that and I'm like the guy who created the cookie, you know, you listen to me and you're either going to do this thing with the cookie, we're going to modify the recipe this way, or you're out. And Augur's not like that. You know, somebody can disagree with me and maybe what we end up implementing isn't actually what I originally wanted.
What are the things that people in the Augur community are most like passionate about, I guess? Is that the positive way of saying like argumentative?
Sure.
Okay. Is there some part of the system that they are very opinionated on?
Yeah, it would definitely be like the reporting system. Historically, like for the trading system, I've kind of been able to suggest whatever made sense. And people are like, yeah, that makes sense. Let's do that. But for reporting, people were like, no. We need to do this and that because like the security model won't stay intact if we do X, Y. People have thought this through probably more than me.
And reporting what?
So the big problem with Augur that we had to solve, if you think about like kind of like you started a company or a project to solve a problem, right? So for Augur, the big problem to create this kind of decentralized betting system was, how do you actually resolve the markets? So Trump wins or doesn't win an election. How do you get the blockchain to know that without trusting like one person? And so the reporting system solves that problem.
Okay. So is it sort of like arbitration, or is that what that's called?
Yeah. Essentially it's kind of like arbitration. Yeah.
Okay. And using Ethereum, do you vote for who won?
Yes, exactly. So basically on Augur, you have this token called reputation. And when you vote at the end of an event, actually, I'll just walk you through the kind of whole thing.
Please do.
At a high level. So the first step is someone who creates the market chooses someone to submit the first report. That's called like the designated reporter. And the idea behind that is to keep the system kind of fast and quick moving. So after a market ends, after betting on, say, the 2020 presidential election is done, and people decide to report, you know, that Kanye obviously won the election, then what happens is the designated reporter submits that report and says, okay, Kanye won. And then after that, one of two things can happen. Either like people just say, okay, that's right, he actually did win. Or somebody can be like, yeah, that's BS. You know, Kanye didn't win the election. And they can stake their tokens or stake their reputation on whoever actually did win. And so what happens is you kind of end up in this series of like disputes back and forth where people are staking larger and larger amounts of reputation. And then eventually either the disputes end and one side is correct, the side that it ends up being finalized on gets all the other side's reputation. So it's very like a kind of like high stakes game of poker almost, or it gets like very contentious and eventually the system actually splits into two universes. So there could be like Kanye won the election universe and Kanye didn't win the election universe.
Wait, we're creating like parallel dimensions where there are they are both true and untrue?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my gosh. That's going to be fantastic. Okay, well, in what world is something right and not right though? Are there a lot of things that are going to run into this problem?
It's a good question. So Augur does have this mechanism called invalid, where reporters can say, you know, this question really isn't a good question for Augur. It's too subjective. This has actually happened. There was a market early on that was pretty contentious about, you know, what will the weather be for the Steel Day parade in France? And the question was actually, will the weather be good or not? And it was like 70 and sunny. So people were like, yeah, the weather was obviously good. And other people were like, well, you know, that's subjective. To one person, maybe a rainy day is good weather. And so long story short, the market ended up being resolved as invalid.
Okay, got it. So hypothetically, like people could vote that Kanye winning the election, if it did not actually happen, he might have won an election, but he probably didn't win the, well, he might win the presidential election. I don't know. Okay. Got it. You can still report it as invalid.
Yep.
Okay. How do you finance something like this?
Yeah. So for Augur, what we did is we did one of the first crowd sales on Ethereum. So that was back in 2015.
And why? So yeah. Why did you not just, you know, we at Boost existed and like other people existed who had money to deploy into things. Mm-hmm. Why did you go that route?
Yeah. So because it was kind of more of a project and less of a company, you know, I thought, so first of all, we didn't really have any like equity to sell. And we were really just auctioning off this token. And, you know, with Augur, the kind of the core concept is like that it's very kind of like pro free market and all that stuff, you know, about, you know, creating prediction markets to get better forecasts, et cetera, et cetera. And so we were like, okay, you know, why not just do an auction? Because it's very appealing to kind of like the internal economist within.
What was that year?
That was 2015.
Oh, so things were low also.
Yeah.
So true. It was difficult to like shop anything other than Bitcoin anyway, a Bitcoin related thing.
Yep.
Okay. You know what I love is that everyone got rejected up and down Sand Hill Road. I don't love that, actually. Sorry, that isn't the part I love. I love that like out of that came this, everyone now looks down on the ICO as less than almost the, like a fundraise for mm-hmm. some reason. But it was created out of the necessity for projects to fundraise.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you look at Augur, because of the way, like the reason actually Augur is unique in that the reason it required a separate token is because of this forking concept, right? Where like you can have multiple universes.
The multi-universe.
Yeah. And because of that, you couldn't just use Ether because you can't just like print Ether for different universes. It's kind of super weird and bizarre, right? And so we needed to sell a separate thing off.
And how did you get the word out about your auction at that time?
Yeah, so we really just talked to people about Augur, you know, whether it was at like a community event, like giving talks at like conferences, developer meetups, posting stuff on Reddit. We basically would post a blog every few weeks about like how far we were along, like solving this Oracle, we called this problem the Oracle problem, how you get that real world information into the blockchain. And so we really just tell people about it.
We have a couple of those. Okay, so then you had the ICO, then you became a venture capitalist. What happened in between those two things?
Yeah, so 2015, we released an alpha version of Augur on the Ethereum testnet, did the crowd sale in like August. And then in 2016, you know, probably like late spring, early summer, we released a beta version of Augur on the testnet. 2017, we did a bunch of security audits, geared up to launch Augur in the summer of 2017, then found a very critical bug in the smart contract language we used on Ethereum at the time, which is a language called Serpent that nobody uses anymore. And the reason nobody uses it is because we found a vulnerability in it, or actually Zeppelin, the auditing firm we used, found a vulnerability that would effectively allow you to like steal users' money and do tons of really bad stuff. And so we basically had to rewrite everything.
Feature or bug?
That one's definitely a bug. So we had to rewrite everything over the next year. And then Augur finally went live kind of summer of 2018. And then the venture capitalist part, you know, I've been doing a bunch of angel investing since like 2016. I'd started like an angelist syndicate. And one of the deals I did through there was a project called Zero X. And I'd introduced them to, so I did invest in the seed round of them and alongside Polychain Capital, and then introduced them to a couple other VC firms, one of which was Pantera. And after that, really, Paul and I just kind of started talking back and forth a bunch. And they're looking to bring someone on who was like a technical partner, kind of understood how the underlying tech worked in this space. And so I decided to join. But that was actually in 2017. And the kind of reason for that was I thought, you know, if you look at stuff like Augur and other projects like it, there's a lot of underlying infrastructure that needs to be funded and for that to work. And so I decided that kind of allocating capital and helping decide what infrastructure got funded would be something I'd like to do. Although I had no way of knowing that that all of Augur would have to be rewritten, you know, immediately like 2 weeks after I made that decision. But I decided basically to hire a bunch of people to kind of head up engineering at Augur and make sure that that transition happened smoothly. And in practice, I think, you know, development of Augur rapidly sped up after I joined Pantera because it forced me to like delegate to people, hire new people to work on it, that sort of thing.
Decentralize.
Yeah.
Forces you to decentralize things.
Yeah.
And now that you've been a venture capitalist for like a year and a half now, two years.
Yeah, two.
Yeah. And you were angel investing before that. Mm-hmm. Like what are you looking for now and how has the market sort of changed?
Yeah. So the market's definitely changed a lot. When I first started investing, you know, ICOs weren't popular. This was kind of around like just after Augur did theirs. And so there weren't that many. And then in 2017, there were a ton. And that was kind of the main way people raised money. You know, we had to try really hard to find equity deals in 2017. Most of them were all ICOs. And then in 2018, it completely swung back. And, you know, vast majority were our equity deals. So it's kind of like then this pendulum that kind of goes back and forth. I think we'll start to reach some sort of steady state probably 6 to 9 months from now where people start doing ICOs occasionally. But it's more like how during the days of Augur when we did ours, where you really only do it if you actually need it because you're kind of fall into that project or protocol category as opposed to a regular company doing an ICO. Those are kind of the big differences I think I've seen.
So it's mostly fundraising differences. The market is bigger than it was. Mm-hmm. Like what voids are you hoping to get filled in this next 18 months?
Yeah. So the biggest voids in the market, I would say fall into kind of a few categories. One is fiat on-ramping, getting dollars into crypto in an easy, succinct, simple way without really leaving the app. I'm actually wearing the jacket of a company called Wire.
We're okay with that. Yeah, that plug.
Yeah. So they're working on solving that problem because the problem is basically like if you're using an app like Augur or something, or something like 0x or whatever it may be, and you get to it and the first step is like, okay, get Ether. And you're like, what's that? It's this weird volatile currency that I'd never heard of. And it's like, okay, maybe I'll make the jump. I'll get Ether. Then you tell the user, okay, now take a selfie with your passport. And if that doesn't work, take a selfie with your driver's license, wait 5 days, and then you can send up to $500 to the site. People are going to be like, what? And that's what happens. It's basically like 99.9% of users get stuck.
Someone on Twitter, I saw they had incentivized their roommate to pay them back for something. They said, you can pay me back 20% less if you pay me back with DAI from Maker's DAI. Uh-huh. And so, but they didn't have any crypto. So they had to literally start from scratch. And the process looked like a 15-step process, basically, to link bank account, buy. And then they had to open up a MetaMask. In order to, it was like a ridiculous, right. They were showing this, the text thread where it's like, wait, now what do I have to do? It's funny. Okay. So on ramp.
Yep. And I think the second biggest thing is after that, the scalability problem still is a really big problem. And there's some stuff launching in a few days. Cosmos is supposed to launch. Polkadot's supposed to launch at the end of the year. So those are some projects that are trying to solve that problem. But I don't know how practical those solutions will be or like, you know, how actually solved they'll be when they launch. But
what is the thing that we're all going to be using without knowing we're using the blockchain?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, stuff like, this one's not in my portfolio, so I can say it, stuff like Guesser, you know, they're building stuff, you know, on top of Augur where, you know, if it weren't for having to use MetaMask, having to get crypto, which is a huge pain, and you know, transactions being relatively slow, you would have no idea that it used Ethereum underneath the hood. And I think those three problems are kind of, it's the same answer to the first question, which is they're kind of the still main open problems to be solved, and probably the most valuable problems to be solved, in my opinion.
And have you seen anything interesting in non-fungible token world?
Yeah, I've seen some stuff there, like people doing like non-fungible tokens with like video games, which appeals to me. I don't play video games anymore really, but I used to play them a ton in middle school. So I think that would be cool, especially like the concept of like...
I just had an N64 game night the other night and it was great.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. We should do that here. Sorry, continue.
Yeah, so like stuff like that, you know, eventually I could see it extending to kind of weirder stuff like, you know, people buying like virtual or electronic artwork, you know, that kind of stuff. I think the non-fungible token stuff is probably pretty early though.
Okay, and what is your time frame in your head where, you know, these investments are going to start to be realized by the public? Like my mom will end up using, maybe it's not crypto, maybe she's gambling on a prediction market, but like at what point for the Oscars, but at what point do you think like my mom is using this?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think...
I love you, mom.
I think probably at like this 3-year mark. You know, I think if you look at kind of like what's happening right now, you have these solutions that are starting to go live. It's probably another year to work out a lot of the kinks, probably another year for projects and current infrastructure to migrate over to whatever does kind of launch and end up working well. And then maybe another year for kind of awareness to start to build. And then it kind of goes from there.
How do you balance Augur and Pantera individually, like working at both?
Yeah. So
on both, I guess.
Yeah. Almost all my time is spent on Pantera. And then for Augur, it's really kind of making sure that the roadmap like is aligned, progress is being made, things are being done the right way, that no super crazy decisions are being made on the protocol or product side, that sort of stuff. Just making sure things are going well. Like right now, the big milestone for Augur is a successful version 2 launch, which will have like support for DAI, so a stablecoin, a bunch of other like UX improvements. That's kind of the main stuff we're working towards on that side. And I'm mostly on the high level there, just making sure that it's going smooth, taking part in the Discord discussions and arguments and debates, that kind of fun stuff.
You're the figurehead. You get to speak your mind and people either agree or disagree.
Yeah, I mean, that's true for pretty much anybody in that chat group though. You know, I think there's a lot of debates in there. Like if you want to see a fun debate, you know, about really obscure stuff, you should check out the Augur Discord game theory chat.
we'll open it up to questions in a second, which will probably be even better questions than I have. A lot of these companies in the audience, they're crypto, they're early, mm-hmm. First 18 months, let's say, 2 years of building. If you went back in time to when you just first came up with the idea of Augur and you were like, yo, Joey, and you time traveled in this multi-universe forking system that you've created, what is that advice that you would give them?
Yeah, I would say the biggest piece of advice I would have is, you know, I think we fell into this trap a bit of, you know, I'd read all the kind of startup books about like iterate, be super lean, kind of that sort of thing. And I think that works if you're trying to build like a Snapchat competitor or something, right? But I think if you're building kind of low-level infrastructure or stuff that's in a space where the infrastructure itself is pretty nascent, I think it makes a lot more sense to really plan out and fully think through what you're building and fully think through the implications of what you're building. So if I look at Augur, you know, we spent a lot of time like iterating on designs that we had already coded up, when in reality, you know, we probably should have just spent the first full 6 to maybe even 9 months. This is extensive. I wouldn't recommend this for a regular company, but for a project like Augur, even the first 6 to 9 months of just iterating on the theoretical concepts in terms of like a design technical spec before actually building them out. For a company, you'd want to shorten that timeline up a lot, but I would still say, instead of just building a ton of stuff super rapidly, really think about your technical architecture, because we probably wasted a lot of time just rewriting stuff over and over again as we realized more.
you know, in the centralized world of building a company, like I, as a founder, have this idea and then I have to find a first hire or a co-founder. Mm-hmm. How did you find the first other people to work on your project?
Yeah. So, you know, when we started, it was a couple of people like Jack Peterson, who we just met online. We met in Skype groups. A lot of crypto discussion happened in Skype groups back then. And
I was invited to that early Ethereum one, and I was like, let's stay focused on Bitcoin, everyone. I made a mistake.
Yeah, that's how we started building on Ethereum, actually, is Vitalik messaged us on Skype and was like, hey, you should try building on Ethereum. And I was like, I don't know. You know, it's kind of like, I don't know about the inflation model or any of this stuff. And I just kind of tried to build what I built on Bitcoin. It took me about 6 weeks, and I was able to build the same stuff in about 36 hours on Ethereum. So that's when we switched to Ethereum. But I think to answer your real question of like how to get people on board.
6 weeks to 36 hours. See, if I had heard that before Ethereum launched, I would have put all the money into Ethereum. But that is a exponentially better service.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you met all in the Skype groups.
Yeah. And then onward from there was really just, you know, as we started posting on Reddit, that sort of thing. And we always kept all the communications open. So like you could always join. We used to use Slack, but our community got too big. And so we didn't want to pay like some ludicrous amount to Slack. So we switched to Discord. But since it was always open, people could kind of always debate whatever they wanted. Some of our hires we found through that. Some people just kind of started contributing code. And
in this world, is there like an org chart, or is it just sort of flat organization, or how to...
Yeah, it's pretty flat. I mean, there's like, if you look at kind of development on Augur, how it works, there's not really an org chart, but there are like, you know, people who own certain parts of it, right? So there's like a team of people who focus on the UI. There's a team of people who focus on like the middleware interactions between Ethereum and the UI. And there's somebody who kind of like keeps track of like all the stuff on GitHub, like all the issues. And you have this stuff in any open source project where like somebody whose job it is to make sure that like issues are getting actually like read, addressed, implemented, that sort of stuff. Kind of like an engineering manager.
The GitHub person.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. As a non-technical person, I did not know that was a position, actually. Now I do. It seems like an important job now that I think about it.
Yeah, it's one of the most important ones because they're kind of the person who keeps the trains running on time and makes sure that like if a user complains about something, that the complaint gets addressed.
That's like engineering ops.
Boost VC writes the first check into sci-fi tech founders. We are all about investing towards a sci-fi world. If you want to get in touch with me, follow me on Twitter at Adam Draper or email me at podcast@boost.vc. Let's build the future.
Okay, how do these organizations build out? Okay, how do you picture them sort of working? You no longer need to build projects or companies geographically in the same area. Mm-hmm. That's being blown up. Open source is sort of the only trend that no one can ignore. Well, there are probably other ones, but no one can ignore it. Like, how do these organizations work most effectively? Has anyone written a book on this? Because they should. Can you write a book on this? Crypto management.
Yeah, I think, you know, we still have a lot to learn before we're ready to write a book, I think. But but I would say, yeah, I think you know, in terms of like expanding organizations like this, I think I like the model of having kind of like small teams of people where those teams kind of like keep each other within the same team accountable. And then there's people who kind of oversee kind of like longer term vision to make sure that things are generally like, if you think about it like a ship, the ship's generally going in the right direction. You know, if you're heading to Hawaii, you're heading to Hawaii and not taking a detour to Australia, that sort of thing. And then people to kind of make sure that within those teams, that those individual teams are like actually making progress towards whatever goals they're trying to go towards.
And are there any tactics that you've used while you built or like assisted in building Augur over the years? Like, I mean, how big is the team at Augur now?
It's probably like maybe 17 or 18 people now.
17 or 18 people. Well, I mean, I can picture. Are they from all over the world?
Yeah, so there's a good chunk of people in the U.S., and then there's some in Europe and Canada.
And do you think that things will end up centralizing, or is this just how the protocols, DApp. Do you think some things are better centralized versus decentralized? I guess that's my question.
Yeah, I mean, if you're building like
cookie shop.
Yeah, if you're building a cookie shop, yeah, it makes sense to have, you know, central production line, all that kind of stuff, right? But I think if you're building a protocol, you know, it makes sense for it to be more distributed. Like if I look at Augur, if I had just kind of called all the shots in terms of protocol design, Augur might not be live today, or it might be live, but like there might have been a huge security vulnerability that caused it all to blow up because I missed something that community called out. And so I think that's probably the most valuable thing is like, it's definitely slower.
How hard was that? So you had to give up some power, right?
Yeah. I mean, that I think wasn't very difficult because we'd always been pretty open from the beginning. It was just at the beginning, there weren't actually that many people who actually like knew enough to make a decision or to like call a shot that would actually change the course of things. At this point, there are people who know enough about how Augur works to be able to say like, hey, like, Joey, I see what you're saying, but like, you're probably wrong here.
The reporting should be different.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You don't get it. But at some point, you did have to relinquish a little bit of power. There must have been a moment where you were relinquishing.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say it was probably when, at that point, it was probably like in 2016, 2017 maybe, where like, we had people in the community who actually just knew what they were talking about, where it would have been irresponsible not to at least take their opinions into consideration.
That's really interesting. Okay, well, thank you. I'm going to open it up to questions and I'm going to let you guys have a more intimate circling up of things. But thank you so much, Joey. Here, give him a round of applause. And thank you. This was great.
What do you think about the future of privacy coins and how that'll kind of affect the ecosystem?
Yeah, it's a good question. When I think about privacy coins, the question is always kind of like, is that its own thing in and of itself, or is that a feature? Investors think about this a lot in regular companies as well. You have a company where they're doing something and it's such a small thing, you know, is that its own a feature of a bigger company or is that its own thing? I think with privacy coins, right now they're their own thing because building blockchain tech is hard. It's all pretty slow. And so right now, if you want to do something with any decent speed, you gotta kind of focus. But I think a few years from now, that pendulum probably switches and stuff like Ethereum will have privacy benefits due to tech like Starkware or regular ZK Snarks. So I think it's an interesting area. The way I think about privacy is that it's one of those things where people don't value it until it's gone. If you look at the US, like with Facebook, people didn't really care about it until they realized that it was kind of too late. And then now there's like all this negative press and publicity about Facebook, even though their business model has been that for the past decade. And I think it'll be kind of similar in crypto where I think privacy here is a feature, but it's an easier feature to add on. Like in Ethereum, there's no way to prevent someone from adding privacy in. Whereas on, say, Facebook, no matter how much I want it, I can't get privacy on Facebook unless I just stop using it.
If we're building primarily on top of Ethereum right now, how do you think we should like think strategically about other blockchains, side chains that may be important in the future, but it's sort of hard to tell right now? Mm-hmm. What's the way to handle a situation like that? Was that a concern at all with building Augur? Like, oh, we'll build it on top of Ethereum, but Ethereum will be disrupted.
Yeah, that's definitely a risk. The way I think about it is I think anybody who, if you're building an Ethereum competitor, you should probably make it compatible with the EVM or at least with Solidity to compile down to WebAssembly to then run on your blockchain. So I think if I look at most Ethereum competitors, they're running one of those two things. Like you can either use WebAssembly or the EVM on it. And so the way I think about it is like there's maybe a 60 to 70% chance that if something does beat Ethereum, it's compatible with your code base. And so I think it makes sense to build on Ethereum right now because it's the only thing that's really live and it kind of maximizes your odds of being able to just port your code over. But I think if something came out that was, you know, massively more scalable than Ethereum and didn't use Solidity, it could probably still get traction. It would just be a slower process. It would slow everyone's dev cycles down and be kind of more of a pain to migrate to. And it kind of remains to be seen what will happen there because all of this stuff was funded like 18 months ago and all of it's supposed to go live in the next 6 months, supposedly, which means it's probably going to go live in 12 months. And so a year from now is going to be really interesting. And I don't know what's going to happen, but I think there's probably a 50 to 60% chance that your code will still work on whatever ends up winning. I mean, it might be Ethereum still.
Hey, Jay, thanks for the talk. So what investments did you guys make? Are you the most excited about some recent investments you guys did at Pantera?
Yeah, I'd say recently, you know, definitely Wire not wearing their jacket just because it's comfortable. I think they're doing really valuable work, which is making it so that you can basically get dollars into crypto or get euros into crypto without leaving the dApp that you're in. And I think that's important because it's going to, I think, 10 to 100x improve conversion rates on apps. There's some study that Amazon did that, I think Amazon did this, that shows that like every 100 milliseconds of latency causes a pretty hefty loss in conversion, I think like greater than 5% loss in conversion rates. And so if you think about like 5 days of latency, well, that's a heck of a conversion loss. And so they're really solving that problem a lot. Besides them, you know, we invested into Bakkt, which is basically kind of institutional grade exchange for crypto stuff. That's interesting because I think it'll get more institutions on board. More and more people on Wall Street will be able to actually get access and exposure to the asset class and be able to trade it. So I think that's interesting from an investment standpoint. And then I would say a lot of low-level infrastructure. Like we invested in a company called Synthetic Minds, which is basically a program that makes it easier to write secure smart contracts. So you can write assertions. Like you can say this contract will never have less money than it thinks it has. And their software will try to provide a counterexample where that's wrong. It uses basically symbolic math to do that as opposed to just like brute force fuzzing. So I think that stuff's kind of cool because it makes developers' lives easier. We're looking at a couple other deals in the pipeline right now that make developers' lives easier as well. So I think those are things that are important to make it to kind of go from like the community we have now to something like the web where it's super easy to build on top of. It's important that we make that transition.
So what were the biggest hurdles you see when developing Augur as a code base?
So Ethereum tooling is not really made for people who have multiple smart contracts that interact with each other. Most Ethereum tools start to fall apart when you get above 5 to 10 contracts interacting with each other. They're just not really written for that. I would say even stuff like, you know, the amount of code you can store with any given smart contract, there's limits to that on Ethereum. It depends on your contract, but it's around 400 lines or so. Stuff like that's on a smaller side. I'd say, though, bigger stuff is just making smart contracts secure. So trying to write tests for them, make sure that you don't have any security vulnerabilities, that sort of stuff. A lot of the tooling that's built up around ensuring that smart contracts are secure, again, isn't really written for contracts that involve, you know, pretty different interactions across other smart contracts. And so those tools either don't run or they throw a bunch of false positives or they just don't work on suites of contracts like Augur. Besides that, I would say the other big thing has been writing decentralized UIs. So it's very easy to make a user interface that's 95% or 99% decentralized. It's 100 times harder to make one that's entirely decentralized. And so if you look at Augur as an example, the user interface is something that's not hosted by like any one website. It's like right now it's stored on IPFS. There's security concerns with that because if you use local storage, then any like domain that you access IPFS through can snoop into your local storage. Somebody else is accessing another website on the same domain. Lots of weird stuff pops up when you try to create a website that's not run or operated by any one party. And so I think that's like the biggest time sink. Another example of this is like Augur doesn't have any central servers that store all the data. So if you think of a white regular web app, like say serving like a page of search results from eBay, that's very easy. They just fetch it from their database and serve it up to the client. But on Augur, the end user has to have that data because there's no server that they're going to ping. So the question is like, okay, well, how does the user get that data in a fast, efficient way? Those are still problems that we're still working on really truly solving. You know, right now it's actually still pretty slow in my opinion.
Hey, Joey, appreciate having you here. So you mentioned earlier the Oracle problem. What are your thoughts on the existing solutions out there and the Oracle you have that you use in Augur?
If you look at Augur, the kind of property that we want to maintain for the Oracle and Augur is that it's incentive compatible, meaning that it's secure given some like security constraints that we're well aware of. And so for Augur, those constraints are if there's ever more money locked up in contracts that the Oracle's resolving than the value of reputation in the Oracle, then the Oracle's insecure. So that's something that's very easy to reason about. You can kind of write like mathematical proofs about it. You can think about it from like a behavioral economic standpoint. You can do all this stuff with that. If you look at kind of a lot of the stuff that's live today, like oracleize.it on Ethereum or like Chainlink or whatever it may be, it's a lot harder to get those kind of formal bounds. And so it makes it a lot harder to reason about. And so when I think about Oracle systems, the number one property that I want is that the Oracle doesn't have an incentive to steal your funds. Or if they do, you can very clearly see when they have incentive to steal your funds so that you can either stop using it or get your money out. If you look at the negatives of a system like Augur's Oracle, it's pretty slow. Right now, Augur takes, you know, at a minimum a week to resolve markets. In V2, we have some kind of cool stuff that we can still maintain incentive compatibility and get that number down to 24 hours, kind of on the best case scenario. I think to go faster than that, to get payouts to be like within minutes or an hour or so, you have to do like basically algorithmic resolution. So where the Oracle's like fetch a result from somewhere else or fetch a result from multiple APIs and come to consensus upon that. The big open research problem there is, how do you prevent someone from making like a malicious API where it provides inconsistent results? So like the problem here is, the classic attack vector here is like, okay, you have a market, it's like, what will the price of Tesla stock be at the closing bell on Friday? And everyone's fetching the result from the same API. But the API, depending on when you call it, provides a different answer. And so like, you may call the API and get $123. I may call it and get $124. Somebody else may get $121, et cetera. And the results are inconsistent. And you don't want to punish people for that because they didn't do anything wrong. All they did was just call the API. But you also don't want to not punish them for it, because in a consistent API, the people who gave differing answers are actually just lying. And so there's not a good way to know the answer to that. There's some like ideas like this thing called TLS notary that lets you prove that you got a page from a certain website or that you made a certain HTTP call and got a certain result. This might be more than you wanted to know on this. I'm not sure. This thing called TLS notary that allows you to do that. The problem with TLS notary is that the person who creates the proof can actually provide a false proof unless you run this thing called TLSN, which is confusing because it's a very similar name, but it's actually a different piece of software. TLSN lets you run something on a web server, and then if you call the web server and get a result, you can actually mathematically prove using a proof that you got the honest result. That's great. The downside for TLSN is you have to convince whatever API you're calling to run this software. So for the set of problems, I think, where you have like an API provider who's willing to run TLSN, those are great because you can basically get a trustless Oracle, no incentive compatibility issues, and it works smooth. But it's hard to find providers who will do that.
Hey, Joey. So we all know crypto and decentralization are good. What are your views on this super awesome and highly exciting enterprise blockchain market?
Yeah, I think for enterprise blockchain stuff, I haven't seen a lot that's like super appealing to me there. Mostly because I don't really get it, in the sense that like, if you look at a lot of the benefits of blockchains, most of them arise in very low trust environments where you don't necessarily trust the other person or you don't know who the other person is. Anytime you kind of decompose it down to being something that's kind of like run by one entity, it starts to become more and more trusted and it starts to become less and less of a blockchain. Like if I take Ethereum and I run it as like a federated network with a handful of nodes, that might actually fulfill some business use cases, but it's not like the same Ethereum. It's kind of like, it's different. And I'm having trouble coming up with an analogy here, but it's not the same thing. I think if I look at enterprise blockchain long-term, I think we will see some enterprises very long-term, like a decade plus, start to actually use public networks. You know, the concept being that like, if you're JP Morgan and you don't trust Goldman Sachs, why would you trust Goldman Sachs on a network where it's just a multisig between you and Goldman? Because you still have the same trust issue. Or instead of a multisig, it's a proof of authority network with you and Goldman. But you might trust Goldman on like a encrypted, you know, ZK snarkified public network where nobody on the public network even knows that you guys are transacting together, and you can do it in a way without trusting either party. But I think that's a ways away because it's like a pain from compliance reasons. Getting that approved by any corporate kind of monolith structure would be a huge hassle. But I think it actually does start to fulfill some of their business use cases.
Hey, Joey, I totally agree with you about fiat on-ramps. Wire is a great company. There are other companies doing great stuff too, but I just had one question about scalability. In your best guess, how long do you think it'll be until we see a blockchain that could support, say, 1 billion concurrent users?
Yeah, I think we may never see that. If you look at that question, right, and you kind of boil it down, it may be the equivalent of like saying, you know, will we ever have a server that supports a billion concurrent users? And like, if you look at Facebook, you know, they have tons of different servers, right? And so I think if you look at it from the blockchain level, we may never have like a unified layer one based chain that supports a billion concurrent users, but we may have a sharded blockchain that supports a billion concurrent users, or we may have like a base layer like Ethereum that has a bunch of like Plasma style side chains that if you sum them all up, they can support a billion concurrent users. So I think that's the way I think about it. So to answer the question from a timeline perspective, you know, I think probably at the 2-year mark, 18 months or so from now, we'll have blockchains that support, you know, a couple thousand transactions per second. And so to get to a billion, you'd have to have a lot of like side chains. And you may, at this point, you might actually have more side chains than apps, which you don't want because you want each app to kind of exist in its own side chain. So, you know, you probably need to hit like 10,000 before a billion is more practical. And so how far away are we from 10,000 TPS? I'd say maybe 4 years, you know, something like that, 4 to 5 years.
Hey, hi. So actually I wanted to ask about stable coins. So the first thing is regarding the liquidity of stable coins. I don't think it's going to match the liquidity of transferring such like fiat currency or cryptos due to the obvious reasons that Ether had and TrueUSD is having currently. Plus, don't you think being a crypto guy, you should not promote the fiat currencies of central governments because the future should be like the cryptos are going to be the main currencies. And if you are again pegging it with the fiat currency, then you are giving value to the fiat currency more than the cryptocurrency ultimately. So what's your thoughts on these things?
Yeah. So I think there's like two different types of stable coins. You know, there's ones that have fiat in a bank account somewhere. And those definitely very directly support fiat currency, right? You're basically buying up dollars, throwing them in a bank, that sort of thing. I don't think those are very interesting because you have kind of all the main drawbacks of the existing banking system. You can't really do anything that you couldn't do in the old world. Stuff like DAI, though, I think is more interesting. It's a decentralized stablecoin where it's backed by Ether as collateral. And there, that's a lot more interesting because you can actually use it for all these decentralized finance apps. And it doesn't really have the regular banking system limitations. Some people still make the argument that, you know, well, because it's pegged to the dollar, you know, it supports the dollar or like you're tied down to the dollar or whatever. And I think that's just a question about, you know, how practical you want to be, right? You know, would it be great if we had like a global currency that was like not controlled by any individual nation like Bitcoin and then it was super low volatility? Yeah, that'd be cool. But I think it's a long time before Bitcoin's volatility gets to levels that low where people can actually engage in transactions with it. And so, you know, if you look at a company like Guesser and their users, whenever they place a bet, have to not only think, okay, I'm confident that, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody is going to win the most Oscars or whatever, but I'm also confident that Ether is going to stay flat or go up over the same amount of time. Or if I think Ether is going to go down, I have to figure out how much I think it's going to go down by. So doing things in purely crypto without any sort of stablecoin is really hard right now. 100 years down the line, I think it, you know, it'd be great if we don't have one tied to fiat. But I think from a practical standpoint, you know, using something like DAI, it does make sense to tie it to some sort of fiat currency. Or maybe, you know, you could tie it to like a basket of goods. Then you get away from the fiat angle. Like you could tie it to a weighted basket of, you know, 100 kind of common goods that people buy on a daily basis, and you still get low volatility, but it's pegged to an asset. The dollar is kind of just the first thing they chose because it's simple. It's easy to wrap your head around it, that sort of thing. But it certainly doesn't mean that they could change what they peg it to in the future. And that's actually the cool part is the maker token holders decide on that. So, you know, if you disagree with it, the idea is that you can actually vote against it and kind of vote to use something else.
Last question.
From a project management perspective, I was wondering, I remember, you know, back in the day, although now the narrative around prediction markets is pretty much Augur, at least in Ethereum. I remember when it was all about Augur and Gnosis, and the different designs were pretty much that Augur was doing its own oracle and Gnosis was not. And I think they relied on a fork of Ethereum of some sort. Well, so how was the decision-making process of saying, well, we're going to take the hard way forward, which is, you know, making our own oracle, deploying the resources and time into that, while seeing other projects that, you know, well, we're funded to take shorter approach, which looking back has not been very good, but at the time it could be plausible.
You know, the way I thought about it was the hard problem, and this problem can still be iterated on and made better, but I think the hard problem to solve was, you know, the oracle problem of how do you get that real world answer to resolve the market. And if you kind of punt on that problem and you don't solve the hard problem up front, you're just kind of delaying the inevitable, which is either you're going to choose something very practical or what feels practical, which is you basically just choose a trusted third party to resolve it. And then you're basically back to Betfair, which is like a popular betting company where you trust them to do everything. And so to us, it was about like, you know, actually maintaining decentralization and ensuring that things remained peer-to-peer. And so if you don't have a solution to the Oracle problem, you don't really maintain that, in my opinion. The thing I always used to say to people when explaining this is, if you tell the user, hey, there's 1,000 trusted third parties, you can pick one of them, and that means it's decentralized. It actually doesn't. Like, there's 50 different car companies around the globe that you can choose to pick a car from, but it doesn't mean that like the car company has like a peer-to-peer structure or something. You're still picking a car from a regular centralized company. And so I think if you force a user to choose, you know, a centralized provider, you're still basically having a central point of failure. And so for that reason, I think that's why we really stuck with the hard problem of like solving that problem before launching Augur. We wanted to ensure that it stayed peer-to-peer.
Cool. Let's give Joey a round of applause. Thanks for coming.
Thanks.
Unfortunately, we don't have time for Mark Zuckerberg today. So subscribe to the podcast and tune in next week. Thank you so much for listening in during your busy day to learn about all these awesome sci-fi people. For more information on what we do, check out our website at www.boost.vc. Also, we love to hear from our listeners, so rate us, drop us a comment on any streaming service you use. We would love to hear any feedback. Until next week, I'm Adam Draper, rocketing to the future. Pew, pew, pew!